Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 180 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, we have Brad Soner. You know Brad Soner, cycling commentator, cycling personality. I've been meaning to talk to Brad for a while and had the opportunity now first so we could chat about just what life is like now with all these cancellations in the cycling world and making sure that everyone's safe and how we go forward as freelancers. And that's where the conversation started, but then we got into the meaty stuff of cyclocross nationals and the broadcast and all of the cool stories behind that. So I think this is a show that from both of those fronts you're really going to dig. It was awesome sitting down with Brad and really having a good hour-long chat about the weeds of cyclocross production. Before we get into the show, I'd ask you all, while you have some time at home, to go to yourcleanbike.com and check out everything that Works Tools has available, from the Hydra Shot power washer, great time to start doing that spring cleaning, getting everything cleaned up in not only your garage, but all the bikes too. You can use the shop vac that they have. They all use the same battery share that you can go from one tool to the other. And because they love what we do at the Wide Angle Podium, you get a discount. So if you go to yourcleanbike.com and put in the code GEARUP, G-E-A-R-U-P, all one word, you'll get 15% off of anything in your cart from yourcleanbike.com. It's an amazing deal. Many of your fellow Wide Angle Podium members have taken advantage of this deal and are raving about it. So get in on that. Also go to whoop.com, take advantage of 15% off of 12 to 18 month subscriptions. You get the 3.0 Whoop band. It's going to get you all of data you need to know on your training, from how much strain you're putting out during the day to how much rest and recovery you're getting at night. And it gives you a number and a green, red, yellow light system of where you are on that day and how you should be performing. The red ones mean that you need to take the day off, get some rest, get some recovery. Green means you're good to go. Yellow, you're kind of in that, you know, middle land. I don't need to explain to you how traffic lights work. Whoop.com. Put in the code WAP. Get 15% off the 12 and 18 month subscriptions. Finally, wideanglepodium.com. Go check out everything we have going on over there. It's a ton. That's three tons of stuff for your ears. They are magical tons in that they actually won't weigh down your head. Just hours of content for you to take advantage of while you are social distancing, which you should be doing. Okay, Brad Soner, episode 180 of Cyclocross Radio. We're talking to Brad, and we're doing that right now. Brad Soner, I guess this is a hard question to ask, but how's it going?
it's been better as a freelancer in the world of cycling in the era of coronavirus, but trying to stay positive and keep my head up.
Yeah, let's just jump right in and start talking about that. And I think even, you know, we all know about the races and we're all bummed about, especially in Europe, all these big races that we're not able to follow. But I think from kind of where you and I are sitting, it's more the trickle-down effect of people who make their living off of covering these races and working the races and everything else, and just the really kind of the devastating effect that this is having on that economy.
Yeah, I mean, really, there is no good answer, you know. You cancel the races, obviously that majorly affects freelancers all the way down the line, but obviously holding the races poses a pretty major public health risk at this point. And so, yeah, it's a tough spot to be, but, you know, ultimately I think we just have to look at it and kind of realize what's best for the country in general. You know, losing a job for 6 months is tough, but having a major percentage of people getting a disease, possibly dying, is a lot tougher in my book. So, you know, as tough as it is, I don't want to say that I'm happy to give up the work, but, you know, I think we're starting to realize that it's a necessary evil, and for most of these races, it is the right call.
Yeah, for sure, and that's what I'm seeing on my end as well, especially with events that, you know, this is kind of the beginning of my season, you know, after a few nice weeks off after Cyclocross Worlds, but then jumping right in into the mountain bike season. And I think one of the disconnects that a lot of us have, you know, we were talking about it a little before we started recording, was just that it's not necessarily, you know, you and me, hopefully, that are going to be affected by this, because we're not in the age range that's at risk, but it's that if you're carrying this, and especially if you don't know, you're infecting people who are in vulnerable classes. So that's what I still think, just looking at cycling Twitter and looking at even with the NBA, what they did last night, is that that's the part that I don't think people are really grasping. And we all kind of just have to chill out and take the hit for now. And I think, you know, that's the best course.
Yeah. I hate to call it delayed gratification, but you kind of have to look at it that way, that it's going to be bad for a while, but it could be a whole lot worse in the longer run if, you know, if we don't take action now. So,
yeah. Well, and I guess the thing is, like, you know, it was a good time for us to chat because of that, but also because we kind of have some downtime now. But I did want to talk to you even before all this happened, just because I think you and I are in similar positions, in that a lot of what we look at from kind of a top-down look at cycling and how cycling is covered is what we can do to improve it. How do we go forward? You know, we hear all these cries about, hey, you know, we want to see race coverage, and the media doesn't do anything more, and there's nothing out there, and it's a huge subject. But I think that, you know, it's technologically speaking and everything else, it's starting to move in a direction that maybe we can do more. So just, you know, I mean, generally, what's sort of like in the front of your mind now when it comes to that? I know that's a huge subject, but, you know, what are you thinking about these days as far as coverage and what we can do?
No, I mean, you know, obviously video is a huge part of coverage in 2020, and video is sort of our language, and definitely the best way to represent, you know, any sport, but certainly cyclocross is a very visual sport. You know, to see the mud and see the pain and see the racing, it's a sport that really lends itself to actually seeing the pictures as opposed to, you know, reading about it. It's very hard to convey that in words. So, you know, video is exciting. Live video is, you know, a whole nother beast that we've been trying to solve for going on 10 years now of, you know, how do we get affordable live video coverage that's still of decent quality and still watchable. And it's just been a journey of trying to find that balance. But, you know, I think going forward, it's really a balance of a little bit of live events, you know, finding the right events that need to be televised and need to be shown live. But then also having a comprehensive video program outside of live coverage, which is a huge part of it too. You know, a lot of races we see live coverage, but then there's no highlights, there's no interviews, you know, nothing's broken out afterwards. And so I think the biggest part of it is sort of creating a video ecosystem for the sport. And, you know, speaking about cyclocross specifically, it's a combination of having live events, but also having weekly updates and interviews and, you know, things like the Cross Report or the Heat Check, or, you know, shows that help expand that landscape.
Yeah, and I think that's any sport as well. It's you need the narrative, and it's even, you know, this is something I struggle with a lot. I mean, what is the value of everything you just mentioned versus necessarily having to have broadcasts live, especially for a sport like cyclocross?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can only tell so many stories during an hour long live window. You know, there's only so much that you can do during a live broadcast. We hear, yeah, that's a very common phrase to hear, is we need to do better storytelling. You know, we need to highlight the athletes, whatever, but that's pretty hard to do in a live broadcast setting. And so, you know, going back to using the term of ecosystem, it's important that, you know, we have those supporting taped video pieces, to tell that story and continue that story, so that when it does come time for a big ticket live event, you know, the groundwork has already been laid. And I think that's what we're sort of missing, is a centralized, you know, storyboard, storyline, but also having all of our media work together so that we can tell those consistent stories across both taped and live events.
Yeah, and that's the I guess what I'm always looking at with cyclocross, and the thing that always comes that is different from, you know, we always talk about the difference between Europe and the U.S. from participatory versus spectator sports, is that most of our UCI events are taking place in the U.S. On days that most of the people who are interested in watching them, at least now, you know, we don't have this non-endemic customer base, spectator base. They're usually out there racing. So my whole pitch has always been, I'm just curious about your thoughts on this, about getting away from the notion that everything has to be live. Is there a live stream? Do you have a link to a live stream? And getting into even a, you know, edited multi-camera production that is more of a, you know, world of sports production that may be tape delayed. You know, I know we don't tape things now, but for that, so that people are looking at it Monday. And I think that can draw in people more because you can do more. I mean, you have skills in editing and everything else. You can put something together better than just having dealing with, okay, we have these three cameras now, we're going to live produce it. And, you know, that's always, you know, the productions you do are awesome, but that's always just living by the seat of your pants game, that you're going to get the right cameras at the right time. And that's what's going out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially with live coverage, I think it's really important to set a threshold of quality in that, you know, not doing a live stream is better than doing a bad live stream. And so if we are going to try and create live products, you know, they need to be good quality live products that people actually want to watch. Because if you don't have enough cameras and, you know, you don't have the right lenses and the show's not well produced, it becomes a bad postcard for cyclocross. And that, you know, we really need to avoid putting that stuff out in the world, because you never know, you know, you only get one first impression. You never know who's going to watch. And a bad live show, can be pretty damaging to the sport. So, you know, yeah, you're absolutely right. The most important thing is that we focus on quality, I think. And that probably does look like less live and more tape shows. But, you know, as you know, you still have to have camera operators out there. You still have to rent the camera equipment. You know, the incremental cost to go from a multi-camera tape production to a live production is, I'm not going to say minimal, but, you know, it's not as big of a jump as going from nothing to a tape production. So, you know, like all sports, it's about figuring out what the right product is for our budget and being realistic about it and being realistic about what can be created in cyclocross.
Did you see any of the BMX coverage from Nationals from the past weekend? I was putting that together for the mountain report. Yeah. And I'm like, I was just so jealous watching that, because it looks beautiful. And A, the races are like a minute long, and B, it's one freaking camera.
Oh, I mean, BMX, yeah, BMX is made for TV, you know? I mean, like, short competition format. The field of play is no bigger than a football field. And that's one of the biggest struggles that we have with cyclocross. I mean, anyone that's ever seen you on a live stream running around with a 22-pound camera rig trying to, you know, get shots all over the course, the wide field of play is really what makes cyclocross incredibly difficult to cover, because it ends up requiring a lot of cameras, and if you're doing it live, a lot of cables.
Yeah, or what the other piece of that, because I can, you know, something like Baltimore and Charm City, what I realized this year is, and they're cool because they have a scaffolding sponsor, which is the most amazing thing. So they built these camera stands, is that in certain situations, I actually went out and have this little, you know, rating system for venues across the country. Some are incredibly, I don't know, easy is the word, but much, much more doable with one or two people, three people the most, plus some, you know, static cameras that you can cover it. Other, you know, iconic U.S. venues, nearly impossible to cover. I mean, you're going through woods, you're going through all these things. And I think that that's something that, you know, if we want to do this on a national level, unfortunately, is something that has to be taken into consideration. What venues look good on TV?
Yeah, I think there's two things that need to happen when you consider a live series of trying to get multiple races together. One is that those races have to be TV first. And this is why people always say, oh, it looks so much better in Europe. Like, let the Europeans do it. You know, the Europeans should be shooting this. Why does European cyclocross look different than American cyclocross? Because it's TV first, because the TV has a hand in designing these courses. And we can look at a course feature that the designer wants to put in and say, you know, this is going to be really hard for us to cover. Could we move it over here? It'd be a lot easier for our cameras to cover. And so, you know, if that starts happening, it certainly lowers the burden that we need, as producers to cover these races. And then the other thing you mentioned is the economy of scale. You know, if we get more races together and we have a series, I hate to be the guy that once again references the mythical USGP, but if you do have a series that runs together, obviously then we can negotiate better rates with vendors and contractors and stuff like that for multiple events. So it's very weird, I think, for Americans to think about this concept of we're going to come to your race and tell you where you can put the sand pit and where you can't. But that's how, that's how cycling got to where it is today, as a riding focused sport instead of an entertainment focused sport. You know, it's always about what's the best course, what's the best for the riders, as opposed to what's the best for the fans and what's the best for TV.
Yeah. And it's little things, you know, that you can see certainly, you know, you look at even as like the things that you, if you're watching on TV, the things that you will notice is that there are sponsor banners on the far side of the track, but not on the near side. There it's only a piece of string. Why is that? Because that's when the camera gets that view, you get to actually see the riders coming through that section the whole way, and it's not in the way. And that's what you're talking about. It is TV first. You know, I know just going through like being around when UCI and the TV broadcasters and the course organizers for the US World Cups are doing their walkthroughs. That's what they're talking about. You know, they're not, you know, it's they want to have a good race. They want to make sure racers are safe, but it's really, you know, first and foremost, how many angles can we grab from this camera and how's it going to look like a professional race? And that's, it's just a different, you know, again, it's coming from what's supposed to be a grassroots sport. If you want to take it to that next level, if that is the goal, these are the things you have to worry about. And those sacrifices may have to be made.
Yeah. And you have to understand from their perspective. I mean, you look at a live crowd versus, what a live stream is going to bring in. If you had 20,000 people at a cyclocross race in person, that would be a great day for an American cross race. But 20,000 people on a stream is, you know, not a lot. We can easily reach 50,000, 100,000 people on a live stream. And so, you know, as you realize the widespread impact of a live stream and how many people will be watching, it starts to become more and more important. And, you know, the broadcasters that are paying a lot of money to both broadcast it and for the rights in a World Cup situation. They don't want to screw it up. You know, they don't want a bad product. And so they really take charge.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about is as well with all of that. And here's something that I don't know if you've seen this. One thing that, having gone to a lot more even smaller races in Belgium this year, is that the other thing that they do is they do a good job of almost restricting access to where crowds can go. So they know that, you know, from your point of view as a broadcaster, what you want to see is a huge crowd cheering on. You know, we're looking at a situation right now where we may have sporting events with no crowds in there, and everybody's like, that's just weird. But yeah, when we're looking at bike racing in the US, that's kind of normal in a lot of places. And what the trick that Europe does, yes, they have more fans, but they also are like, you all are all going to stand shoulder to shoulder right in this section, and it's going to look amazing. And then other places of the course, and you don't see it because just they're good with camera angles and everything else, the crowds aren't as big, but they don't get criticized that because you see that one section where it's an amazing. I think we can see that even at some of the nationals that we've done. Like this last year was great. You had those run-ups and those downs where everybody was kind of stuffed in there, and it was a good crowd and it looked great on TV.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, nationals, when we had, you know, the view of that run up, we had a jib from the sand pit and then another camera on a pretty high platform that was shooting that run up and then a camera there. You know, the audio was exceptional. It looked great with the people there. It was just awesome. You know, when you have that 10 seconds of the riders on the run up and then coming back down too. There was a great crowd, you know, on the way back down where like the moment where Katie Compton made that pass at the very beginning was just like, you hear the crowd roaring and it's like, that's a great sports television moment. You know, that's, you really feel like you're in the moment at a professional sporting event at that moment. And it's just about trying to replicate that as many times as you can. You know, when you watch March Madness or an NBA game or whatever, you know, it's not the timeouts in between whatever that make it feel special. It's when that guy hits the three at the buzzer and the crowd goes wild. That's how you know, and that's what makes it feel like a big time basketball game on TV.
Yeah, for sure. So just going back to Nationals from this year and just in the past, how many years have you done like cyclocross Nationals now?
Oof. Let's see. Well, so I started announcing on the PA at Cyclocross Nationals. That was my first time attending Cross Nationals, which was probably going on 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I'd have to look back and start to think about the first Nationals that I did. And even before that, I was working for an event services company that would set up the stage and fencing and all that stuff. So I think I was like 14 during the Providence blizzard year. And I remember hauling fence out of 2.5 feet of snow to load it up and drive it back to Ohio. So yeah, I've been around the races a lot, but really started to get into the video part of it and the live productions over the last 5 years or so. And you know, we've had a lot of really good opportunities. USA Cycling has started to invest in that element of their national championships, which is something that, you know, I really started to push hard when I realized the sort of lack of coverage that we did have for what was supposed to be one of the biggest races of the year for Nationals.
Yeah. So couple different directions here. First of all, you sort of bring up working for that event services company in Ohio. You know, I guess that's where you got your starts. What's your relationship to bike racing? Where did you get started in this? Were you racing as a kid?
So actually, my first introduction to bike racing, I was driving to Mother's Day brunch. I had two brothers, were loaded up in the car with mom and dad going to brunch, and we drove by a local park, and there was a guy in the park with a megaphone and a bunch of dirty, muddy mountain bikers riding around in this field. And of course, having three boys in the car who were like 8, 10, and 11 at the time, we were incredibly excited about getting muddy and riding bikes. And we begged our parents to turn the car around. We saw it out the window and we were like, we have to go look, we have to go see. And God bless my lovely mother. She said, all right, we can go back and look. And we delayed Mother's Day brunch and went to watch a mountain bike race. And then we came back and raced the next week. Fell in love with it, fell in love with the racing element from there. And then the promoter who was putting on those mountain bike races ran an event services company. And so from there he hired me and that allowed me to start to travel around the country. Mostly East Coast and Midwest events, but, you know, we were on the road all summer, driving around when I was 14, 15, 16 years old. You know, kind of seeing the behind the scenes part of the sport. And the more I watched it, the more I fell in love with it. You know, I saw some really good crits and some really good road races. And just had this moment where I was like, this is freaking cool. I mean, and I just sort of slowly fell in love with bike racing. You know, we would set up all morning and then everyone would go sleep in the hotel or pass out in the truck, but I was hanging out on stage watching the racing, you know? And that was kind of how it then transitioned into announcing, where it was like, look, you're hanging around all the time. You got a good voice. At this point, you seem to know the sport and what's going on. Why don't you give it a shot? And then it snowballed from there. So yeah, it was a very kind of long, convoluted process to go from, you know, stopping on the side of the road to making my living producing cycling content. So
and
it's been a long journey.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, yeah, you got the voice, you had the experience with being around the races. Education wise, any J school, anything like that? Or just sort of, I think like a lot of us do sort of fall into this almost from the grassroots approach to it.
Yeah, I did. I went to journalism school. I went to Ohio University, got my bachelor's degree from the journalism school there. But I actually studied advertising while I was there. I had no intention of, you know, going into broadcast. Cycling was my summer college job. And then I was going to get a real job after college at an ad agency. You know, I had it all lined up. I was going to go, you know, work at a big agency in New York and say goodbye to the grifter lifestyle of, you know, driving a truck around. But that's, you know, my, I had a, an advisor, a professor who was in the advertising industry, was sort of my, you know, my guide into that industry. And when I was a senior, basically sat me down and said, you need to pursue this cycling thing for a little longer. Advertising will always be there. You know, I was making almost enough money at that point to support myself, you know, to call it a full-time job. And there was a real possibility that if I really committed to it full-time and was able to invest all my time to it, that I'd be able to make a living at it. So it was kind of a leap of faith after my senior year, but, you know, I figured people take time off all the time before going out in the real world. And then 12, 13 years later, I'm still waiting to go into the real world.
That's great. Yeah, no, that's the way to do it. I kind of was the opposite, came out of the real world and then into this. And then for the past decade, this has kind of been it. But yeah, definitely worth it. It's bike racing is something special. Going back to, I was just going to stick with national championships. What memories come up for you from all of the ones that you have covered? I mean, just from venues or even the racing itself. What really, when you think back about all of the nationals you've covered, what is it that really sticks in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, the Providence Blizzard was pretty legendary, which was followed up by the Hartford Blizzard or Snow Dump a couple years ago. That was maybe the most challenging production that we've ever had to do. I always tell the story about the night before we got a phone call at about 3 a.m., 3:30, that there were some cameras on the ground, which we thought was very weird because we had built them all up and they were all secured and, you know, strapped down to their scaffolding. And so immediately went to the venue to check it out, found some cameras all over. And it turned out that they had sent the snowplows through the venues overnight, which was very nice of the city, except they had snowplowed all of our cables that were buried under snow and, you know, had run across some. We put cable ramps down, but obviously the snowplow just picked those right up. So when we showed up on race morning, we were about 8 cameras short from what we needed to be. So we actually ended up having to borrow some cable from the local university's basketball arena. We were in there pulling cable at 4:30 in the morning because that was the only place that we could find a long enough cable to do what we needed to do. So that was definitely one of the more memorable live productions.
Well, then you put in that whole Herculean effort and you go to sort of flip the switch and what happens?
Yeah, exactly.
The generators yeah. goes out
and,
on you.
And this is live production, but yeah, so it ended up being so cold that the diesel fuel in the generator basically gelled up and didn't allow the generator to run properly. And so, yeah, then we were without power for a good amount of time. And TV trucks do not like to be rebooted. It takes quite a bit of time to get those things back up and running and dialed in. You know, it's not as easy as just hitting the reset button. So that was a stressful one. But we got some of the races on air. You know, we did our best with what we could. But, you know, it's amazing to see how far it's come. Like going back to looking at some older Nationals live streams, I think Asheville probably sticks out as the worst one that we did. Asheville was one where, you know, we experimented with what it would look like with a budget vendor, with a production company that was basically prosumer gear. You know, it's camcorders and low-level gear, but it's affordable and cheaper. But the problem is you can't see anything and it's unreliable. You know, you need those big lenses. Saving money doesn't do you any good if the product ends up being, you know, unwatchable. So it was not only do you start sacrificing on the equipment, but then the staff and the camera operators and stuff like that. You know, we've kind of tested both ends of the spectrum of what it looks like when you spend a very little amount and what it looks like when you spend, a metric shit ton of money on production. So we're trying to find the right middle ground.
Yeah, the thing that sticks out from Asheville for me is that y'all had the
sort of the studio setup where you were doing all the pre-show and mid-show sit downs with people. And then you had, you know, yours and Tim's. I think it was just the two of you, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Your little remote studio where you're actually calling the races. And you all in the production company had one monitor that they had to take from
it was like
one,
a 14-inch monitor, that Tim and I were trying to share.
It was also, but it was
hey,
like
we
after
saved
the
some
race,
money on that, man.
Yeah, they had to unplug it. It couldn't have been a $100 monitor and then like move it over to the other set, plug it back in there so you could see. That was something.
That was also, we also had a legendary camera operator. The camera operators were hired through Craigslist. They just put out a production company, just put out a, you know, day rate camera operator, whatever. And I remember there was this one camera operator who just could not learn the move, you know, that the director wanted. We rehearse moves with the camera operators so they know, you know, how to cover a certain feature, how to move with the camera. You do it over and over and the director sort of picks what they want. And eventually the camera operator said, I'm more of an artistic camera operator, and was unable to take direction from the director, which, you know, that's where you realize why you pay broadcast professionals, you know, to run these cameras. And, it was a big eye opener that you really do get what you pay for, when it comes to these things. You know, on the other end, we spent a lot of money at Nationals this year. The show looked great. I think there was a little bit of waste in there. You know, we probably could have brought that budget down by another $10,000 or so. But, you know, part of that is just the nature of a live event. You know, it's always better to have that backup than to not have it. And sometimes you use it and sometimes you don't. But the worst possible thing that could happen would be a Hartford or Asheville situation where, you know, you don't have a show or the show is majorly affected.
Yeah. And two completely different situations. I know just having spent some time in the truck on that morning and in Hartford that it is completely unfair to see what all of you all are going through on the ground. And then, you know, and it's inevitable to kind of look at social media and just,
this is part of the job, just the
crap you're taking over it. And I think I even put something out there. I was like, if you only knew, you know, it's just like that none of this is deserved, but I guess that's what people see. And it's also, as we both know, you know, having the evil empire of USA Cycling as a client, it's always you're always going to get a little of that from friendly fire from that as well.
Yeah, and you know, people love to blame USA Cycling for stuff. I think it's an easy punching bag for a lot of people when stuff goes wrong. You know, even with the live stream, if there's a bad camera shot or a bad cut or some bad audio on the show, USA Cycling gets the blame, as if, you know, Rob DeMartini is sitting in the truck directing this thing, you know, purposely missing cuts and putting bad audio out there. So, you know, you just have to. People don't understand, obviously, what goes into a live production, and you just have to, you know, do your best show and, you know, create the best product that you can under the situation. But there's definitely a lot of misinformation out there. I hear stuff all the time, like just put a bunch of drones up or add another camera, or, you know, now people have heard about the cell bonding technology. And I think there's a lot of thought that that's going to be this end all be all, that we're just going to, now that we have cell bonding, you know, everything's all of a sudden cheaper and we can do these shows easy. And, you know, it's not quite that easy. And so there's always something going on behind the scenes. When you see something bad on TV, there's usually a reason. You know, it's usually not because just decided that this looks bad and it's okay.
Yeah, and it's also, I think that you can see just the progression that you have made over the years and just the value of having a team that has worked together now for several years. And just, I mean, I just know with the director that you work with, you know, he was kind of in that Asheville. Was it Chris on Nashville? Yeah.
He was there.
He was sort of like learning the sport on the fly. And since that time, I think he's almost even become a cyclocross fan at this point. And he
has indeed. I get texts throughout the year when he's watching races and, you know, cheering on the Americans and watching the World Cup. So, the guy you're talking about is a guy named Chris Lincoln, who has directed a lot of cycling shows. He worked on a lot of the road shows. He came to Asheville for the first time to direct a show. And I don't know why he decided to stick around and saw some potential. But, having a core team, like you said, is huge. Even with truck vendors, trying to explain what we're doing to a lot of these, television truck vendors or camera cable vendors, rental houses. It's hard to do because cyclocross is unlike, any other sport out there. Explaining to the truck crew that all your cables are going to come back covered in mud, is a very hard thing for them to grasp and understand, because what other, and I say, oh, we have to do these long cable runs and all this stuff. And they say, oh, no problem. We do motorsports. I get that a lot, because a motorsports park is generally, close to the size of a cyclocross park. But they have conduit running through. And so it's easy to run that cable through. Most stadiums and venues like that today are pre-wired. They stay wired year round with built-in wiring. And so you just drop the cameras and then it all goes back to the production truck. But the fact that we have to lay all this cable out and, oh, by the way, it's in a 12-hour window, which they've never heard of either. The standard in television production is that you have a set day, the day before a show day. Any arena sport, any basketball game, football game, anything like that, there's a full day of setting the day before where you go in and set the cameras up. But, a lot of times we don't get access to the course until 5 a.m. with, an 8 a.m. race start. And so that compressed time frame is another really unique part of covering cyclocross.
Yeah, and then impressive, you got it up in time to have two full days of racing this year, which was something new. Yeah. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that was definitely another, I would call it a major change to how we, kind of cover and approach what live streaming means, especially to cyclocross. In covering the amateur races in the, the non-elite categories, was really cool. One, because it produced exceptional racing. I thought some of the best, best races of the weekend were non-elite races.
I mean that single speed was dramatic.
That was one of the best races I've ever called in my life.
Yeah.
And so being able to see that, you realize that it really is a numbers game. The more you cover, the more cool stuff you're going to see, and the more of those really cool moments you're going to have. And two, obviously, it is a huge value added for the people racing nationals. And that goes back to how you strike the balance between, is this an elite sport? Is this a grassroots sport? What is American cyclocross? And I think giving amateurs the chance to be on TV at their nationals is a really cool, unique grassroots thing that we can offer American cyclocross racers, participants, fans, that you don't really get anywhere else. It's another unique part of American bike racing. And that goes back to when we were talking about the Europe, European TV. Our day before the elite races is pretty much blocked out because we can't get access to the course because there's amateur races going on in the 6 hours leading up to the elite races before. So, we can't be running cable out there and setting cameras up and stuff. That all needs to be done before the amateur races start so that we're not interfering with that stuff. So that's just another unique part of trying to stream it in the U.S.
Yeah, and then also what I love this year was bringing in that very Euro feeling jib crane shot, which was amazing near the sand. That was super cool. And then you did actually have some drone footage that I really think filled in a lot of the gaps that were possibly missing in other years, which was really cool. I love just moving up the production every time we do this.
Yeah, the drone and jib were a big part of it. There's a couple little toys that you can add to a production that, in terms of value spent versus value added, are relatively good deals. I think the drone was a huge part of that. That allowed us to cover that whole orchard area at CrossNats this year. But getting back to what we were talking about with a TV first production, you know, that orchard, that little cutoff with the run up and, you know, that was really tough for us from the TV side, because it basically cut the venue in half. You know, the cameras couldn't shoot through that thicket. And so it was basically like having to wire a second venue at the top of the run up on the other side of that little wood line. And that would be something that, you know, if we had had a chance to get in there earlier, we could have, we go and do a site survey, obviously, you know, director goes out and looks at, the venue, but that's before it's staked, before it's taped off, before, you know, the last minute decisions are made on which parts are going to be rideable, which parts we're going to use and all that stuff. And so even the night before, you know, it's like, oh, there's going to be this UCI line and we may open it up. We may not, you know, not sure how this is going to go. We got this option. Like, you know, that majorly affects the TV production because obviously we have to have a camera there. And that could mean not just moving a camera, but rewiring a whole chain of cameras, because a lot of times they're all connected. They go to these home runs, these sort of hubs out in the field that then go back to the truck with multi strands of fiber. So it's always changing, and that's part of it. But the technology is definitely making it look better. But I think one of the biggest misperceptions is that this technology is going to make it cheaper, or that it's, you know, somehow getting cheaper. When in reality, as technology evolves, we just evolve video to fit that technology. And so, you know, cell bonding, when we went from 3G to 4G, that was huge. And everyone thought that cell bonding was going to change video. But that was also when we were just starting to get into, you know, HD video, the 480 and into 720. You know, it's easy to get 720 video back over 4G, but then we moved into 1080i, and then it was 1080p, and then it was 1080p HDR. And, you know, that just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And now we're moving into 4K workflows, and soon it's going to be into 8K workflows. And, you know, by the time that happens and 5G is around, all of a sudden you're sending 8K video over 5G, and we're right back where we started with, you know, 1080 video over 4G. So as technology evolves, so will the pipeline will grow, but we'll also fill that pipeline, no problem. So
oh yeah, for sure. It's just like building more lanes on the highway. They're gonna exactly. Fill up with cars.
I mean, it's just you're constantly chasing that, and yeah, as new technology develops. I mean, even the drones now, you know, we're starting to look at 4K shows, and drones are just now coming in where, you know, the wireless transmission from the drone back to the controller so we can get into the TV truck is there. And, you know, 1080p is doable now, but now we're moving to 4K. And it's like, now this drone is behind and we have to catch up with the drone. And the difference between 1080 video and 4K video is pretty significant when you're talking about wireless video for now. And that'll change. That'll get better. But as 4K gets cheaper, 8K will become more standard. And so, you know, we're always chasing. So, you know, we could probably do some shows pretty cheap right now if people were happy with 720 video. Right. But, you know, people start to have this standard of, oh, we want to see it in 1080. We want to see it in 4K, even though, and I think you probably know, you know, when you look at the stats, a majority of people are not watching these products in 4K. You know, if you make a 4K video, even if it's not live, you know, at least from my analytics, you know, generally we stream in the 720, 480 region, which is, you know, people watching on mobile usually. So, you know, it's nice to have that high definition picture, but whether people are actually using it and experiencing it to, you know, to the fullest extent is TBD, to be determined.
Yeah. You know, the reason, like, I'll shoot stuff in 4K, and I think this is kind of the what people are using it for, is it gives you a lot of wiggle room in being able to crop things down, especially if you're sending it out, put it at 1080. So you have this enormous 4K photo video that you can sort of hone in on one and zoom in on something, and it's not going to break down. And, but I did one thing I wanted to mention, which I was just like nerding out over when I was at Hoogerheide, they had a drone up. And it was hardwired. It had this leash on it.
we actually looked at a tethered drone for Lakewood because we were so close to an Air Force base. There were some major hurdles to get through in you know, legally getting a drone into the air and keeping it up there for a long time. And the other problem with, you know, saying, oh, let's just cover the whole race with drones is the battery life of a drone. You know, our drone could at Lakewood basically could stay up for 18 minutes at a time. Our vendor has a system that's constantly charging batteries so that they always have fresh batteries. But you do have to come down, land, change the batteries, put it back up. So, you know, it's not like we can just have these drones flying around for an hour and covering these races. You have to strategically plan when those breaks are, when, you know, so that that drone comes down while, you know, they're not in the orchard where we need the drone. And yeah, the tethered drones are a big part of it. You know, one for battery life and two for FAA clearance, which is getting, you know, crazier and crazier.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's only going to get more restricted as we keep on going forward with more consumer drones. I did want to mention one thing just with the upgrade in camera operators, as well as like what I was talking to one guy, and I don't know if there were more of them who, you know, works Seahawks games. That's kind of his gig, and then was out there shooting this. So, and it was kind of fun. I was just hanging out watching him and just sort of chatting with him, and he sort of, when you're a professional, you kind of pick up what you're supposed to do pretty fast. And he kind of had it nailed right away. This was even on the practice days, you know, the group's going through, he's panning and following the last rider. I mean, it was just like, just almost intuitively, like this is what needs to happen.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is why you pay pros and pay the best. And that's another thing with, you know, with live TV is like, you get one shot at it, you know, especially at something like the finish or a major move, you know, you're resting this entire, what could easily be a six-figure show, you know, on one camera operator at your finish to catch that magic moment of the rider coming across. And if you don't get that just right, and you don't do that perfectly, unfortunately, that's what people remember about the show. You know, if that one bad cut at the finish, or that one time the audio dropped out or whatever. So, you know, it's really about consistency and having those people there when you need it. And ultimately, that's what drives the cost of TV up. You know, we could very easily just have six or seven camera operators out there, but inevitably you will miss the moment and you will miss something important. And then, you know, people will be angry the other way. Well, why didn't you have more cameras out there? Well, you know, why didn't you spend more money? You should, you know, higher budget, whatever. So, you know, it's kind of an 80-20 rule. The last 20%, the last little 20% of the production takes 80% of your budget. You know, it's the last little bit that makes it bulletproof and makes sure that you're there in the moment, that really adds the significant cost of TV. And the other is, you know, the skill required to operate this equipment. You know, if you've ever seen a TV camera, it is drastically different than, you know, a camcorder. Most people can operate a camera. You know, if you handed them for camera geeks out there, if you gave them a FS7 or FS5, they could probably figure out how to, you know, press record and point it at the thing and zoom in. But, you know, even building a TV camera up, attaching the lens to the camera and, you know, getting it all wired in and all the settings is a pretty significant technological barrier. So, you need pros to be able to do that. And that usually means that we're drawing from the, you know, big four pool of people, you know, camera operators that know how to run these cameras. But it is cool to see those people come out to a cross race. You know, it's cool to see them experience it for the first time. I always listen to, you know, the crew in the truck, whatever they find interesting. I usually take that as a pretty strong cue that this is an interesting thing in cycling, whether it's road racing or mountain bike or cyclocross, whatever. You know, when I have a replay operator in there that's never seen a bike race, I just ask them to clip off the replays that they find interesting, and serve it up to us. Because if they, an outsider, find it interesting, then probably other outsiders will find it interesting too. So, you know, while we're looking for clips of like, well, what gear is he in? And, you know, which pedals is this guy using? And like, did he have trouble clipping into his, you know, look cleats, whatever. These people are like, oh man, look, this guy's, you know, giving his friend a banana. That's cool. And, you know, that's the content that people want to see. And you kind of have to step out of, you know, out of our, I don't want to say jaded, but, you know, we develop a narrow look at the sport of what, you know, what we want to see and what we're excited about. And you kind of have to remember that doesn't necessarily apply to everyone. So yeah, it's good to have people from outside the sport, on these TV productions, because it gives us a nice perspective, from, you know, what should be our customers, which are people watching for the first time, or maybe not hardcore cyclocross fans. And the questions that they have too, you know, like, do these guys get along? Is this guy important? You know, who's, you know, I recognize this woman from last year. You know, that was some, we had a graphics operator this year that recognized Katie Compton. And I was like, man, this is, you know, the storytelling is working. Like, he's like, oh yeah, this is the dominant woman from last year. And it was like, you got the story. Absolutely. And you realize, you know, the importance of that. So, yeah, it's fun to have, outside vendors on these shows. It's very interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And then even from the inside, sort of inside the circle of the organization, I've noticed it has changed as well. And, you know, just from a media perspective, we get kind of the same crew are down there, you know, wearing the bibs, running around with cameras. It's the same people covering the sport, but there is a change. Where there are things that we don't see here that sort of that group in Europe that's covering, you know, cyclocross or mountain biking or even road experience that we don't really get into. And what I'm talking about specifically, like I used to cover mountain bike World Cups, and that was Red Bull. So you have the whole Red Bull crew, and if you're in their shot, you're basically getting a heel to the head, you know, and they're going to get you out of there. And it's like no messing around. And just even from like Hartford, where there were issues with that kind of stuff, to now where especially having leadership at USA Cycling on board and you all, and now us in the media as well, we all sort of have this understanding of what's supposed to happen so we don't get in the way of each other's jobs. And that was a huge deal this last national championship, because, you know, your finish line camera was like 0.2 miles away from the finish. Yeah. I mean, it was insane, that throw that you all were making on that. And that meant that we all had to be really careful, and USA Cycling has their folks out there who are making sure we are. And it was a very controlled environment in that scrum and at that finish line. And that's the kind of thing that us, you know, we have to grow with as well and understand what's going on. And I thought that it worked really well this year. And I know there's been tension in the past, but that's kind of the growing pains as well. You want to do this professionally, everybody's got to be on the same page. And I think between the working media to the organization at USA Cycling that knows what needs to happen, then for you all who are actually doing the TV production, this was the year I was like, okay, this is looking really pro, and everything's working together.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're slowly getting there. You know, we're slowly realizing the importance of prioritizing TV and how good it can look when you do prioritize TV. And that, you know, I think obviously Nationals this year, I think, was our best cyclocross Nationals yet. And that was in large part because the venue and USA Cycling made an effort to prioritize TV this year. And yeah, you know, things like the media pit at the finish is, you know, always an issue every year. But because you want those awesome photos, that's a huge part of, you know, the ecosystem of cycling media. But at the same time, you can't miss that one moment, you know, on live TV. And you only, like we talked about, you have one chance at getting it right. And the worst thing that we can do is screw that up, you know, with a big shot of the back of your head or something. So,
yeah, exactly. I've been there, unfortunately.
But you know, you're right. It's very important that everyone has, a seat at the table, and that, you know, you can't just say TV is the most important thing and nothing else matters, because those photos do matter. And, you know, that slow-mo video at the finish does matter in post-production, because all of that is really what creates cyclocross. It's not just the live production. It's everything that comes out the week, 2 weeks afterwards, the highlights, all that stuff. You know, that's important too. And we try and work with, you know, brands and media to make our footage available. You know, if it can help someone to sort of supplement their coverage, you know, we're always willing to help provide that stuff if anyone needs it. So, you know, it's about the good of the sport. It's not about just getting the TV right. It's about producing the best content for cyclocross that we can.
Yeah, that's kind of the boat that I've been in as well. It's like we're not big enough to compete really with each other at some level, because, you know, it's all, we're fighting.
You know, even if we are competing, we've got a problem. You know, that's not the right way to grow the sport and move the sport forward. So I don't even want to say that would be a good problem to have if we, you know, had that much media, but, yeah, everyone's got to work together. And, you know, and the riders too, you know, interviews have to be made available. Maybe the race schedule changes a little bit. That's not ideal for the athletes, but could be better for TV. You know, some of those changes will start to come into effect too. I think we'll start to see some of those changes being made, you know, to make things better for the media production, and the riders will, you know, they'll adapt, they'll get used to it. But, you know, even doing pre-race interviews, you know, trying to sit down with athletes before nationals is like, well, I got to do a shakeout ride, or I need to have my legs up, or I'm supposed to be eating at 4:30, or, you know, whatever. We do our best to try to work around athletes because, you know, obviously I know it's a very specific preparation for what is the most important race of the year for most of these riders. But at the same time, we need a little bit of give and take to have at least some access to the athletes.
Yeah, and I think a lot of them are starting to get that as well. And there are some, definitely some that are better than others. But I think as a whole, they know that that's what's gonna sell the sport.
Yeah, I mean, and this goes back to, you know, one of my pet peeves whenever you ask a bike racer what their job is, and they say, "I'm a bike racer." The right answer is, "I'm a marketer." You know, every single person who's out there wearing a logo, you know, that's why they're there, is to show off that logo. And so, you know, race promoters are not race promoters. They're salespeople, and bike racers are not bike racers. They're marketers. Because ultimately that's what this is about. And that's what makes, you know, money makes the world go round, and we can't ignore that. Unfortunately, you know, we have to hunker down and do some business every once in a while. It can't just be, you know, riding our bikes. So, and just like TV, you know, people say, what is your job on television? To produce a great show? No, it's to market for the sponsors that are paying for the show. You know, it's to create a product that these sponsors want to be associated with, so that money keeps flowing.
Yeah. I was having a conversation with some writer, might have been on Twitter, but it was just about who was the actual customer. And when you're talking about sponsors and, you know, riders are sponsored by this company or that company, it was like, they're not sponsoring you to sponsor you. They're sponsoring you so you're a spokesperson for their customers that they really care about. They don't care about you, the athlete. They care about the people that are going to buy that kit or buy that bike. You know, that's the most important thing. And that's your job. It's not just to get a handout and get cool stuff. It's to be able to sell that cool stuff to other people. And that's
right. And I think, and you know, with the sort of privateer movement, and obviously it's a big part in cyclocross with riders putting their own program together, you start to realize the value of that marketing, you know, in that your sponsor is probably going to care more whether you did the interview the night before the race than whether you got fifth place or eighth place. You know, that doesn't make a huge difference for them, but getting some media, getting a clip on the live show, you know, something like that, that means a lot. And more riders are starting to realize it because they're having to do the business end of being a bike racer by themselves, you know, bringing it in house and putting together your own program. You really learn to value, your partners, your sponsors.
And we'll have that whole discussion and the benefit of gravel racing on the next time we talk.
It's a new economy in cycling these days. That's for sure. I mean, there's a lot of people out there doing stuff that, has never been done before. And we're going to see a pretty drastic change over the next 5 or 10 years here with the economics of a lot of these disciplines of cycling.
Yeah. Well, Brad, normally, you know, when I start to wrap these things up, I'd ask people what they got coming up next, but I'm not sure you can even answer that.
I got a 2-week quarantine coming up next. a lot in flux right now, but we'll just sit back and wait to see. I'll stand with the promoters that make those tough decisions to cancel, because I know how tough that is. And obviously I have some shows coming up that I'm producing. And so we're keeping a close eye on that with the events, and making sure that our vendors and freelancers, are taken care of as best as possible, in a situation like this.
For sure. Well, we'll look forward to those coming out and make sure to check them out and share them with people. But, thanks so much for chatting today. It was, I'm glad we finally got the opportunity to talk. It's good.
Yeah, I'm pumped to finally get on one of your podcasts. So this is awesome.
Outstanding.
I finally made it in the world of cycling.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, Bill.